of mine for several years on the Commission on Theology and Church Relations, where Lowell serves as a chairman of the Committee on Church Relations. You have Lowell's vita on the bottom of your schedule for today, and there's certainly no need to repeat that. But I know that I speak for the CTCR and for many others in the church in stating in front of you all that we have come to admire and to like Lowell very, very much. He is a churchman of great sensitivity and competence. He has some new ideas and some different ways of approaching education, and some of us have heard him on that during coffee breaks and that kind of thing at the CTCR. Lowell, we're delighted to have you with us. I'm sorry that we've had to adjust our schedule a little bit. I hope that your presentation doesn't get squeezed in the process, but come on up here, if you will, and welcome to the seminary, and God's blessings on your presentation.
Thank you. I had come expecting to get you all fresh and eager. I hadn't anticipated getting you after you had sat for 2 hours and are hungry. So what I think I'll do is shift some things around a little bit. I was struck, and I'm kind of pleased in a way that I'm following Dr. Taylor's presentation, because I was struck by a number of things that he was saying and the way in which it dovetails with some things that I want to say. And also by the fact that there is tremendous similarity between the kinds of problems that are faced instructionally at an institution such as this one and at an institution such as the University of Iowa. I, for a number of years, worked with faculty in various colleges on campus in curriculum development, course development, that sort of thing, and the same questions arise over and over and over and over again. It doesn't make any difference what the topic is. It doesn't make any difference what the college is or what the program is. There are a certain set of basic questions that arise. I was also interested in your discussion on D-Min, because, again, the questions that you are asking there, the questions that relate to the offering of such a degree, are exactly the questions that we've been dealing with on campus for about the last 6 or 8 years. In fact, from about the time that it became obvious to us that we could no longer stay on our campus, offer what we wanted to offer, and assume people would come and get it. The whole notion of serving different constituencies, of our student, the shifts that have occurred in our student body, have required all of us in higher education at all levels to take a very careful look at how we've been doing things and how we can serve those constituencies better. The off-campus questions that you are asking, what happens when you offer two degrees, a PhD and a professional degree, whether it's a doctor of business administration or a doctor of education or what it is, what does that do to your on-campus programs? How do we serve those people out there in terms of the courses we offer, how we offer the courses? Now, one of the byproducts of all of this ferment that has occurred in higher education was referred to by Dr. Taylor when he was saying someone was offering a course in a D-Min program, and after having offered it a time that he said, boy, now how can I put that in the stuff I'm teaching on campus? And I think there have been, we'd like to look at it in terms of our being sort of here, and we'll teach those folks out there something. And that's true whether you're on the campus in Iowa City or on the campus in St. Louis. Interestingly enough, what we have found in the work we have done of this kind is that those people out there can, as Dr. Taylor said, teach us an awful lot. It has also given rise to some, they're not new ideas, let me make that clear first of all, but they are sort of revivals of some old ideas that have been around in education a long, long time, but to which we have only given kind of lip service. Their ideas about how we put programs together, how we put courses together, how we make judgments about those programs and courses that we have probably all heard about at one time or another, and have maybe even gone through some of the motions of using, but have then sort of shifted off and gone back to other ways of doing things, the ways with which we feel comfortable. And I guess there are two major goals that I have in mind for the time I have to spend with you. One is, I hope we can share some ideas about the whole area of course development, program development, and maybe you'll learn a few new things, and maybe you won't, and maybe I'll learn a few new things, and maybe I won't. I hope that happens. But more importantly, I guess, I hope that we can, in the time we have here, build a feeling that we need to re-examine what we're doing and the way we're doing it, and to provide some way of re-examining what we're doing and the way in which we're doing it. There are many different ways, I suppose, that individual faculty members will choose to use what I have to say this morning. I guess I liken it to building a bridge, in a sense. I can take three or four architects, and I can ask them to build a bridge, you know, go across a valley from this mountain to that mountain. And I ask them to build that bridge, and they'll all design different bridges. None of them will design the same kind of bridge. But all of those bridges will share certain characteristics in common. There will be certain kinds of things that all of those architects will have had to pay some attention to as they were building that bridge. And I guess this, in a sense, is the way I view instruction, the way I view teaching, the way I view development of teaching, that we simply have to allow, in any way in which we build courses, we build programs, we build curricula, we have to allow the faculty opportunities to express the gifts that they have in instruction, while at the same time recognizing that there are some characteristics in this whole process that all of us should be aware of it, and all of us should build into it. And I'd like to start this whole thing with a sort of a general overview, a definition, if you will, to at least get that straight, a definition of what I'm talking about when I'm talking about teaching. And when I'm talking about teaching, essentially, I'm talking about a process focused on change. Now, that's important. That word is going to come up over and over and over and over again. That, in a sense, if we as teachers have anything at all that we can hang on to as identifying the core of our professionalism as teachers, now not as academicians, not as scholars, but as teachers, if there is one thing we can grab onto and say, that's the core of my expertise as a teacher, it is our effectiveness in promoting change in people. That's what we're all about. And if we can't promote that change, we're doing something wrong. The whole process of instructional development, then, regardless of the level, regardless of whether you're talking about developing a D-Men program, regardless of whether you're talking about a course of studies in Old Testament, regardless of whether you're talking about a specific course in Old Testament, the key factor that we're dealing with is changing people. And we're effective or not effective in the degree to which that change occurs. Now, in a way, what we have as we try to develop that change, as we try to bring that change about, is we are, in a sense, organizers of the lives of people. Now, I'm using some terms. I'm being very blatant here about some things. In fact, I'm overstating some things to get your attention, because, after all, it is 12 o'clock. And so I've got to say some things in ways at 12 o'clock that I might not have to have said them at 9 o'clock or 9:30. But that what we're talking about here, in a sense, is that each and every one of us, every day of our instructional lives, are manipulating the lives of others. Now, I'm using the term manipulate there as because it's attention getting, and I'm going to back away from it a little. I occasionally will hear faculty members say, well, but I don't do that. That's not what I'm all about. I'm sort of in the business of letting people express themselves, be themselves, and that's true. To a degree, that's true. But each and every one of us are constantly making decisions relative to instruction that limit or identify or define what the nature of those changes in those people will be. For instance, I am already doing something about changing in some way, systematic or unsystematic, the lives of the students that I teach when I decide where I'm going to put the chairs. How I'm going to put the chair. We know, for instance, that you get
you get very different kinds of interaction patterns in a classroom if you put the chairs this way as compared to in a circle. Now, why do some faculty put chairs in a circle and other faculty put them in rows? Well, if you ask the faculty member, the one who puts them in a circle might well say, well, it gives the students a chance to interact and talk. It gives us a chance to talk as equals. It helps students develop a sense of belonging, etc. What's implicit in that statement? That I think it's good for students to learn to participate, huh? That I think it's good for students to be changed in this way. And whether I decide to put them in rows or I decide to put them in a circle does not relate to the question whether or not I'm trying to affect a systematic change in them. It simply says I'm trying to change them differently. So that the key point in all of this, I guess, as we look at teaching, as we look at the role of instruction, is this notion of change. And the professor, the teacher, whatever you like to be called, is in fact the person who in some way or other has responsibility for establishing the setting in which that change occurs, and that will inevitably influence the nature of that change. Now, having said that, I want to talk a little bit about sort of the components of that whole system. Can any of you see that? Can you see it back there?
You can thank
my secretary. This whole process of change, the whole matter of instruction in the process of change, involves three components. One, what changes are we going to make? And my guess would be you have probably heard this over and over and over and over again. We call that by lots of names. But my guess would also be that for the vast majority of faculty, and this includes Lowell Shore, this is the part of the process with which we spend the least time. That's in fact what we very frequently do, is we sit down we have one meeting. We say, now what we're going to do is we're going to discuss what we're trying to do here, what changes we're going to try to make in the people that we have. And almost immediately, our discussion shifts to what? What content are we going to cover and what textbook are we going to use? Huh? Because those are the things we know best. And those are the easy things, by the way. That one is tough going. You want to talk about getting disagreements among faculty. That's the tough one to deal with. When you start sitting down and talking seriously about your new degree, my guess would be that's going to be the tough one to make. That's the one Dr. Taylor was talking about when he was saying, go out and see what those people are doing out there. Because what you're going to find is, first of all, determining what it is they do is no easy job. And secondly, determining among you as a faculty that helping them do that better is worth the time and effort, and giving them a doctor's degree for is going to be even more difficult. But you can save so much time later. You can get rid of so much inconsistency in programs if you just identify what those are and do it carefully and do it thoughtfully. Because in a sense, the whole process that I'm talking about here centers around that. When he was talking about organizing the program itself, traditionally we organize programs by content areas, huh? In a sense, what he was suggesting is don't organize by content areas, organize by what? Activities of people in the parish. Here is an activity that occurs in the parish. This is something we have to help people do better. Now, what in terms of the discipline? What in each of those disciplines relates to that particular change? Students come into the program and we assume they do not have at least all of the skills that they need. They don't have all of the knowledge that's required to do a certain activity in the parish. Now the question is, how can we pull all that together? Interestingly enough, What we tend to do as faculty, and by the way, when I say what we tend to do as faculty, I'm including myself in all of this, because I do it just as surely as you do. When we start organizing courses, when we start organizing curriculum, what we say is we will provide the individual courses as they relate to individual content areas, individual disciplines, and on whom does the responsibility for integrating all this stuff and finding its practical implications lie? Rather typically, the student. Now, how many of you have ever served on the new disciplinary committee designed to try to do this kind of thing? Have any of you, have you ever, what was your experience with that? It's difficult, huh? And why is it difficult? Oh, and each of us, sort of in our own way, is tied to a specific discipline, a specific content. A few years ago, we had a big rush on campus for interdisciplinary courses. Interdisciplinary courses which presumably would do a better job of preparing people for the world out there. I invested probably 3 years of my professional life on campus, working with this committee and that committee and who knows how many other committees, to try to develop this whole interdisciplinary concept. It had support from the highest levels. The president of the university came in absolutely convinced that this was the way to go. So that we'd get a sociologist, and we'd get a chemist, and we'd get a mathematician, and maybe we'd get a physicist together, and we'd put them together, and they'd plan a joint course that would relate to areas of interest in the lives, of direct interest in the lives of people. We gave up. Now, I don't know, is that what you did? Gave up? Yeah. No? You still got the committee going? Okay, you keep plugging away at it, and unless you get people working on that who are really willing to focus on changes to be made rather than discipline to be taught, you have nothing but problems. In fact, I guess I came away with the conclusion that the way to do this is hire interdisciplinary faculty rather than get individual. Get hire faculty members who have broad interests to teach the interdisciplinary courses rather than try to get three or four faculty members from disparate disciplines together to try to teach this. Because it was just horrendous. And I can't imagine that this faculty is any different from the faculty we have at Iowa in that regard. Second, experiences to be provided. What are we going to do? We've identified what we're going to do, what the changes we're going to make. What are the kinds of things we have to lay in here to bring those changes about? Now, insofar as available knowledge that we have is useful to us in this whole process, it starts to become useful there. And I'd like to talk at least a little bit before we get done here about some of the characteristics of different kinds of experiences and the impact that they seem to have on students in general across a broad range of disciplines. Now, the third area is that within this approach that I'm talking about, we are always making guesses. We are always making, hopefully, good guesses, but we're making guesses. We say, this is the sort of change we want to make in the students. This is the kind of change we want to promote in students. This is the way we think we should go about doing it. But that's always the best guess in terms of the knowledge available to us. That brings us to the third component, evaluation of effectiveness. And my guess would be that if we have problems up there on one and probably don't spend as much time with it as we should, we probably spend even less time on three. We spend virtually all of our professional lives as teachers on that middle chunk. So I think it's probably a couple of reasons relative to evaluation. One is that very often we haven't been careful enough about identifying the changes we want to make so we're in a position to evaluate, to know whether we've been effective or not. And secondly, because evaluation can be a tremendously threatening business. Because you find out you made best guesses. You made poor guesses. Your best guesses weren't very good guesses. If you're going to do evaluation and it's going to be effective, you better be ready to take your lumps. And secondly, you need to be ready to change when you have to change. You need to be ready to take that evaluation seriously in terms of the changes to be made. Now, this this general model that I'm talking about here, the comments I've made, it seems to me are applicable regardless of the level of instructional planning we're talking about. Whether we're talking about the program level, the course level, the unit level, or the individual lesson or lecture level. There's another point I want to make about all that, and that is that instructional planning, simply has to proceed from, in some kind of hierarchical fashion, one of these levels to the other. You will never be able to do satisfying, I guess I should say, planning of individual lectures until this institution has its direction in order. What I'm saying simply is that the initial planning relative to the changes to be made, the evaluation procedures to be employed, the methods and procedures that you're going to use, have to flow directly from the general goals of the institution. Which means, quite simply, that the institution itself must have identified for itself what its general goals are. And you derive your goals as you move down that thing in a hierarchical fashion, each in turn. Ideally, you ought to be able, and I say ideally, I don't know of an institution in the country where this is true. It's certainly not true at ours. Ideally, you ought to be able, at least within a program, you ought to be able to look at anything you are doing during any lecture period that you have and tie it directly to course goals, to unit goals, or to unit goals, course goals, and program goals. You ought, in fact, to be able to say, I'm teaching this morning because it relates to this, it relates to this, it relates to this, and this in turn relates to the institutional goals. Which means, quite simply, that this whole process of planning that I'm talking about has to begin at the institutional level. You cannot begin planning, even for a program, let's say in the D-Min program you're talking about, unless you are very clear just exactly how that program and how the goals of that program relate to the goals of the institution. And the goals of the institution have to be stated precisely enough so you can make some judgment whether it fits or not. Now, I have no idea that the degree to which those goals have been established, you know, the degree to which that is possible. But once it has been determined that those D-Min program goals fit with institutional goals, then you're in a position to start looking at some course goals. And each and every faculty member, here I'm talking about faculty responsibility, I guess, and I'm going to talk about it again when we get to evaluation. Each and every faculty member, it seems to me, at any institution, has an obligation to do the teaching within the courses that he prepares in a manner which is consistent with the general goals established for the program of which that is a part. Now, that doesn't mean that somebody tells faculty members, this is what you must do and this is how you must do it. But it seems to me that we as professional teachers, have that kind of responsibility to the institutions and the programs in which we teach. Now, the institutional responsibility, on the other hand, in all this, is to have its goals clearly enough specified so that the individual faculty members can do that. Now, immediately, when you talk like this, immediately you're getting into what? Very, very fuzzy and controversial area. And as long as I'm being stark and blatant here, I might as well be blatant on this one as well. Academic freedom. I don't remember ever talking to any faculty group, whether it's in a college of liberal arts or a college of medicine or a college of dentistry or where it is, about this matter without running into the whole issue of academic freedom and what is, you know, what is the role of the faculty in all this. But I think the critical issue here comes insofar as instruction is concerned. The critical issue comes relative to the faculty members being a part of a program and being a part of an institution, which immediately reduces to some degree, at least, that faculty member's degrees of freedom relative to instruction. Now, we won't fuss about other considerations here on that. But if that's to work, if this process is to work again, if faculty are to give up, if you will, at least some degrees of freedom relative to the instruction they provide, then they have to be involved in the decision about those goals when they're established there. So collegiality becomes a very significant part of this whole process, collegiality and trust. But if it doesn't, if we don't have this kind of systematic planning from the top down with those changes at each level being derived from more general changes specified above, what students end up with is just a potpourri of stuff that they have a lot of difficulty pulling together. And then we say, well, students should pull all this together. They should be able to integrate all this. And in a sense, we say they should be able to integrate it because we as faculty couldn't in our committee. And I think that's unfair. We ought not to expect students to pull some things together that we as faculty could not pull together. Now, insofar as the changes to be made are concerned, what I'd like to do is go down through those. One at a time, starting with changes to be made, and then from there go to some very more specific kinds of things relative to some methodology and then into evaluation. First of all, those changes to be made may be determined in many ways. One of the questions that frequently comes up is, how involved should students be in this whole process of setting these goals, identifying changes to be made? It seems to me there are a couple of very good reasons why students should be involved in those decisions. First of all, it is in fact their life. And secondly, they very often have some pretty good ideas. And I think that's particularly true as we're dealing in programs with more and more mature student bodies. I indicated that the approach that I'm talking about here has come to be more widely recognized, I suppose, as student bodies have become more diverse, and I think particularly as student bodies have become more mature. The day when I suspect virtually all of the students who entered this seminary came right straight out of senior college or right straight out of an undergraduate program somewhere, probably passed. What's the percentage, Ralph, of your students who come here? And the rest then came out of?
From different state colleges.
How many of them have been out and working? Have had jobs?
Bill,
are you positioned to get Ireland and Templeman?
Yeah, well, I would, but not a very high.
Okay. But that's going to be a different world when you get to the DMIN program. Perhaps as importantly as any of these is the idea that it gives the students the feeling that they have a stake in this thing. Now, that doesn't mean that you hand students the right to set the program, or the right to identify what those changes shall be, the right to establish goals. Do you have a student committee of some sort that works with faculty? Because there's a whole batch of these kinds of questions that arise where, in fact, whether we as faculty like it or not, the students may have some better information than we have. And again, I think it's important here that we recognize that we as faculty are responsible for the overall and accountable for what happens in that program overall. But that the students themselves are likely to be able to provide us with some insights are going to be critical for us. Secondly, those changes, as I indicated earlier, become the very hub of everything we're going to do, of every judgment you're going to make, of every evaluation you're going to do. They are going to be the basis for making judgments about how you're going to teach. Again, I think what happens is that we tend to say, well, basically I'm a lecturer. Or I think students ought to do, I think every student ought to be able to write a paper in every course they take. You think that's a good idea? Think every student ought to be required to write a paper in every course they take? Well, maybe. Huh? I don't know. It depends on what? Well, what are you trying to do? Maybe if that paper can be shown to make a significant contribution to bringing about the changes you're talking about, then fine, it makes sense. If not, then what? It doesn't make sense. And how are students likely to interpret it? Yeah, busy work. All you're doing is trying to harass me. Huh? You're trying to give me a hard time. I'm perfectly willing to do it if you can show me that it has something to do with what's going on. And the surprising thing about students is that I'm amazed at the amount of work they're willing to put in if they can be shown that it relates to something that's important in the program of which they're a part. Students, by and large, will work their tails off if they can be convinced and can be shown, how does this relate to something that's going to help me do what I'm going to have to do when I get done here better? Are lectures a good idea? A good idea to give lectures? Well, yes and no. Sometimes it's a good idea. Other times it's not a good idea at all. I get so tired of reading articles about people blasting lectures, saying, you know, lectures are the worst things in the world. Worst possible thing in the world. Well, doing certain kinds of things in a classroom, lectures can be extremely effective and very useful. But I sort of get equally as upset when I see people using lectures for what are simply inappropriate reasons, hoping to make changes in people that aren't just likely to happen when you start talking about using lectures. Now, another is that these changes, I've used the term here over and over again, should always zero in on the changes to be made in students. The goals are not changes we're not talking about changes that we're going to use in methodology. But they are always oriented to the student and how that student is going to change. Now this gets to the heart of one of the hassles in terms of these changes. Oops, let me get down. I suspect that some of you here, and I know that fair numbers of people around about, when I talk in other institutions, get concerned that as soon as you start trying to apply this approach to the development of instruction, what you're doing is you're only paying attention to sort of surface changes, huh? That what you're doing is the only changes you can identify are sort of the trivial ones. Have you ever heard that? That the changes that are really important are the changes that occur inside and you don't know if you've done those or not. So what's the sense of identifying all of those external changes? The point I would make on that is quite simply that unless we can identify how the way people act is going to change, how they behave, if you will, and I don't like that term much, how they respond out there in that world, how they relate out there in that world, we simply have no basis for making much of any decision about what we're doing instructionally. That does not mean internal changes are not important. That does not mean that internal changes do not occur. But it does mean that, humanly speaking, we're limited to those. That's all we can see. So in a sense, when we talk about the whole process of evaluation being a piece of this, was it effective? Did I do something that made a difference? Do I need to revise something here? We've simply got to put it in terms of something we can see. Let's use critical thinking as an example. Suppose I say that one of the goals that we ought to have in any program, in any institution, and referring back to Dr. Taylor again, is to increase the student's ability to think critically. And I say what I'm going to do, that's one of the changes we want to make. Over the 4 years students are in this institution, they should think more critically as seniors than they did as freshmen. And I'm going to try to build into the program the kinds of experiences that will promote that kind of development. I'm going to make guesses. I'm going to try to lay those in there. How many of you have ever seen a critical thinking? You've never seen a critical thinking in your life. Huh? Now, does that mean it doesn't exist? Get wax philosophical here for a moment. Well, to me it doesn't, but you, at least in terms of how we're limited, you've never seen a critical thinking in your life. What's the only way you have of knowing whether or not the program that you have developed has, in fact, increased the student's ability to think critically? Again, is by what they do, huh? By what they say, by what they write, by the way they interact with other people, by the way they respond to other people. Now, that doesn't mean I don't have a phony once in a while. You know, somebody who can use the right words that seem to reflect critical thinking, but they doesn't know what they mean. And generally, if I probe a little bit, I can find that out. But insofar as developing instruction is concerned, I've got to identify not only that I want to increase the ability of students to think critically, but I've got to identify what are the kinds of situations in which that ability should assert itself. Because that's going to have an influence on how I go about teaching, it's going to have an influence on the content I use, it's going to have an influence on teaching methodology I employ, and it's certainly going to have an influence on the basis on which I evaluate the effectiveness of what I've done. Now that in no way means that you know what the... these things just consist of a whole list of very detailed behaviors that we lay out. But what I'm saying simply is that, again, in higher education, it seems to me what we have done in program development, in course development, in lecture development, is we have left our statements of changes to be made at such a high esoteric level that we have no way of being wrong. Huh? Now, there's comfort in all that, but it becomes extremely difficult for us to make some of the judgments we really do need to make. So that in a way, very often, the development of these kinds of change statements may start at this very high level, to develop, to think critically. But then we've got to go to that next level, and we've got to say, to think critically in these kinds of situations, and it should be reflected in these kinds of things that people do, in these kinds of judgments that people make. And by the way, what tends to happen, you remember earlier when I was talking about going from program level to course level to unit level, sort of the lecture level, what tends to happen is that these statements become more and more precise as we move down there. That in a way, and to a very, very significant degree, what I'm doing is that I am increasingly operationalizing, if you will, the general goals at the institutional level by the way I teach my courses. That is, I am taking the general institutional goals and I am converting them into more precise statements that relate to what I'm doing in a course. And I may relate those to still more precise statements about what I'm trying to accomplish in a given lecture. But that somewhere along here, this whole thing has to be laid out in this manner so that I can see what's going on. And then the last one, the next one there relates to it directly. The last one that I have there relates to, should be a part of an integrated pattern. And I think I've probably said enough of that so that about that process. So no more needs to be said. We can pick that up maybe later this afternoon.
I'd like to talk a little bit. We spent a lot of time talking about goals. And just by way of kind of review comments on that, over lunch today we discussed a couple of things. And that's where some of the best things that come into my mind is when I'm eating lunch with somebody. But I think, again, to apply what I said earlier this morning to the specific situation here, the whole notion of goals and the importance of goals and being straight on what those are, I think are going to become very, very evident to you as a faculty, particularly when you start looking at the new program you're thinking of. And again, I hope you don't mind if I share some war stories with you.
because we've gone through some of the things on our campus that I think you're probably going to be going through with this, and that is that any time you offer two sort of parallel degrees, unless you're very, very clear what the different goals are for those two degrees tend to start looking alike, and your upper-level degree suffers. Now, I'm not saying that as a disadvantage of the DMIN degree. I'm saying that simply as an illustration of the importance of being clear about what the goals are. That is, that if you are going to offer a second degree, I don't care what it is, whether it's a different bachelor's degree or a different master's degree or a different PhD or a different doctoral level degree, if you're going to offer two degrees at the same level, first of all, it seems to me you have to have very, very different goals in mind. It doesn't make any sense to offer two different degrees. And secondly, if you do offer two different degrees and you have only vague notions about how those two degrees differ in terms of what the goals are and who the people are to be served, what will happen is that inevitably those degrees will start looking alike. And you're going to find yourself in the situation that many, many colleges of education around the country have found themselves in relative to the PhD and the EdD. That what tends to happen is the two look almost alike, except that in the one case you have to have a foreign language as a tool requirement, and in the other case you don't. And at that point, you have lost whatever reason you had for having two degrees in the first place. And the students get cheated for whom the other degree was intended, and the faculty gets all confused, and so do the people who are trying to make some sense out of your degree program. So I'm just using that as another illustration of the importance of being clear about where it is you're trying to go and what it is you're trying to help people become in the course of the programs you plan. to go to the second level, the second stage in that process that I talked about, the whole matter of the experiences you provide. I just want to make a couple of comments about methodology, teaching methodology. I, for purposes of convenience, divide teaching methodology sort of into three parts, three pieces. First of all, those that I call pre-instructional. Then a second group that I call instructional. And a third group that I call post-instructional. Now, isn't that clever? You could call them 1, 2, 3 if you want to, or A, B, C, or something. But under the pre-instructional things, I guess these are the things we do in classes in order to prepare students for what we're going to do. In a way, it seems to me one of the soundest principles of instruction is when dealing with students, tell them you're going to tell them, and then tell them you told them. And in a way, pre-instructional, instructional, and post-instructional sort of fall along those. In the pre-instructional area, what you're essentially trying to do with students, it seems to me, is one of three things. You're trying, first of all, to reduce anxiety. I don't care what the course is. Students come into courses with a certain level of anxiety. And what you ought to be doing very, very early in the course, one of the first things in the course, is to tell the students what they can expect in that course. What you're trying to do, where you're going, how you're going to get there. Because it can help reduce some of that anxiety. And it strikes me there is enough anxiety that occurs in the life of students by accident without our having to build it in. There are enough uncertainties that are already there. Secondly, these pre-instructional things that I'm talking about can serve a very significant motivating force. They can be a significant motivating force. It seems to me one of the most significant things you can do with students prior to beginning the actual instruction in the course is to tell them, to show them how this fits into some broader framework of what they want to do that's important to them. So that they know, they can see, I have to take this course because this course is going to help me do this, and this relates to something I'm trying to do here. A third is that it establishes what psychologists refer to as SET, I don't care what you want to call it, but it provides a general framework within which people can put what happened. Among the, we don't know all that many things for sure about the nature of human learning, but one of the things we do know with some degree of certainty is that we tend to retain best that which we can place in some larger framework. That is, students are very likely to forget very, very quickly those things which they learn as isolated instances of something. And if you don't provide the students at the beginning of the course some general framework that they can use to see where it is all this thing is going and how things fit during the course of that instruction, what you provide them will very often sort of just slip up.
It'll just disappear. Psychologists talk about the notion of anchorage. The idea of those things which we retain are those things which we're able to tie to something we already are familiar with. And when you talk about the pre-instructional things I'm talking about here, that's essentially what it amounts to. So these are the three things you're really trying to do, it seems to me, at the start of a course in terms of instruction. You want to reduce anxiety, you want to motivate the students to get them into what's going on, I mean, you want to provide them some general conceptual framework within which they can work. I guess, again, to talk about specifics, I'll say I typically spend at least a class period and very often two class periods doing nothing but that. Simply explaining to students how come they're in there anyway and what we're going to do. Now, there are a lot of specific ways you can do that. Course outline. And by the way, this does not mean providing them with a syllabus that's that thick. I presume some of you at least have taught in systems where every faculty member had to produce a syllabus that was at least 75 pages long. That just overwhelms students. With 14 pages of very specific objectives, a few years ago we went through the specific objectives things, and teachers and faculty spent hours and days writing down all these itty-bitty things the students were going to be able to do when they got done. By and large, nobody paid any attention to it after it was written. It used up tremendous amounts of teacher time, tremendous amounts of faculty time, and there really wasn't any advantage to anybody. Don't think that's necessary. But I do think that students are entitled at the beginning of the course to at least have some idea of the topics to be covered, the order in which you're going to cover, and why you're covering them, so that a course outline can be very useful. But there are a lot of other things you can do in there, too. Course goal, course objectives, if you will. And by that, please don't think of objectives in terms of these many, many pages. But just give students some idea of what changes you expect them to make in their lives as a result of taking this course. Some faculty find the use of questions. These are the kinds of questions that we will be concerned with here, even in terms of individual days, to say, look, as we're going through all this, these are the questions I would like you to consider. Now, you have a correspondence division here, don't you? Okay. I, for a number of years, have been involved in the development and use of correspondence work, and one of the, in terms of feedback from students, one of the devices that I've used in correspondence study that I've gotten the most favorable feedback on is providing students with a set of questions. These are questions you ought to consider when you study the material that you're going to be studying here. You can do that same thing in lecture. Say, look, these are the kinds of questions you ought to have in mind when we're talking today. Or these are the kinds of questions you ought to have in mind and be trying to find an answer to. In a way, what you are doing is using this pre-instructional thing sort of to get them thinking, to keep them thinking, to keep them active. Terms of what you're doing. Some faculty have found the use at the beginning of the course in terms of a pretest. Now, I'll tell you where a pretest is where I found it most useful. If I've got a group of students who come into a course who figure they don't need it because they know it all, it's hard to just convince them that they know it all. Sometimes if you spend the first day saying, look, what I'm going to do here, the first day of class here, to give you some idea of the kinds of things we're going to cover here is, I'm going to give you a test that's a parallel form to what the final test is going to be. You've got some idea what it's all about. I'd like all of you to take it. Now when you get done, we'll come back tomorrow, I'll have it scored, I'll pass it around, and then we'll go down and we'll talk about each of those questions, and we'll talk about how those specific questions relate to what we're going to be doing in this course. It's surprising how much humility you can build in there, provided the questions are difficult enough. Huh? And it also, the advantage of a pretest of this nature is that it's tremendously relevant to students. They'll pay attention. You can pass out sets of objectives, and you can pass out course outlines, and you can pass out a lot of stuff at the first day of class, and they'll kind of sit back and say, oh yeah, I guess so. But you give them a test the first day of class and tell them this is like the test you're going to have as a final, and they pay attention, because there's nothing you can do instructionally that catches students' attention quite as much as a test. To do it the first day of class like that catches attention. And if that test is carefully written and if it's well written, it can, in fact, do the things that all these other procedures that I've talked about could do. There are others that could be used, but essentially, guess what I'm talking about here is at the beginning of the course, students ought to have that kind of information available to them. Then, in terms of within course itself, there's just four or five things here that I want to comment on because they get so widely discussed by faculty. One is the whole method of what's the best methodology to use. I referred to it earlier. Should you lecture? Is it better to use papers? Is it better to use films? Is it better to use transparencies? Is it better to sit on a table? Is it better to stand behind a podium of some sort? And the only answer I can give you to that is yes and no, exactly the answer some of you gave earlier. It all depends. It all depends on what you want to accomplish, and it all depends on who the students are. Which means that methodological decision has to be made only after you have carefully identified what? What changes you want to make? What effect you want to have? I said that those identification, those changes become the hub around which everything else goes. I can't tell you whether a lecture is a good idea or not until you can tell me what? What effect am I trying to have? What am I trying to do? I can't tell you whether it's good to use a film or not until you tell me what it is you're trying to do. One of the factors that arises here is the whole matter of, are there certain kinds of modes of presentation that are kind of intrinsically superior to other modes? We've recently reorganized within the College of Education, and the division that I have now has about three times as many faculty in as it had before, and one of the things that's coming into that is a whole group of stat and measurement people, and the stat and measurement people, many of them at least, are very fond of chalkboards. I don't know how many of you can remember your last stat course, but I'm absolutely convinced you take the chalkboard away from a stat professor and he's tongue-tied. Okay, there's nothing wrong with that necessarily, except what's the problem with using a chalkboard to put all those formulas on the board? Math teachers in general, I think, do this all the time. All those proofs. Putting them on that blackboard. In fact, I remember the guy I took advanced statistics from could write with both hands. Literally. Oh, Paul Blommers would go across the chalkboard with both hands. I was trying to figure out if he could come from one end to the middle, you know, and write backwards with his right hand and frontwards with his left. Well, what's the disadvantage of that? What's the problem with that? Time, huh? Do you have any idea how much time can be wasted in a class writing everything on a chalkboard? When you've got a very simple electronic medium right there, huh? You can get it typed, it's easier to read. Better yet, you've got a ditto machine and you can just hand it to the students and talk about it. Now, that's not to say that chalkboard is not useful, but it is to say that for certain kinds of outcomes and for certain reasons, it's not very useful. Just because people can see it in special ways doesn't make it all that useful. Another of the group of the people that I have in the division I had are the audiovisual people. And I have more hassle with AV people. Would you like to guess why? I'm not anything against AV people. Films are a tremendously important thing to use in class. You can bring things into classrooms via films that you can't touch any other way. But what's the problem with AV people? Everything's got to be a film. Anybody who gives a lecture without a film obviously wasn't being successful. So that each of us in our own ways, we sort of identify specific ways of doing things, and that's the best way to do it. Then you've got another group of people who would insist that the only way meaningful learning occurs is if there's small group discussion. You ever talk to these folks? That there is no place in education for any large group. That as soon as a group gets larger than 8 or 10 people in it, then meaningful learning cannot occur. To which I reply, nonsense. That's in my more charitable moods, I reply, nonsense. Huh? Now, there are certain kinds of outcomes and certain kinds of goals we're trying to reach in education that we simply can't reach anywhere except in small group discussion. And the hassle is that very often what we try to do is use small groups when we could just as well be using the efficiency of large group presentations, or we use large group presentations when what we're trying to accomplish can't be accomplished in large group presentations. Not unless at least you've got somebody who's a real spellbinder by way of being able to deal with large groups. And we're talking, again, over lunch. How many of you have heard George Farrell speak? George has been on our campus. I've known George for years and years. And George teaches an undergraduate, basic undergraduate course in religion and human culture, I think. And that course will have 400 or 500 students in a lecture hall. He's just a spellbinder. He'll walk in that lecture hall, and 3 minutes after he's in there, everybody in that he's got him in the palm of his hand. And you can't convince me there isn't some really meaningful learning going on in that setting. You know, but how many George Farrells are there around? So it relates not only to the outcome to be achieved, but also who the people are you have. So the advice I would give relative to methodology is hang loose. Familiarize yourself with a broad range of methodologies and use those which seem most appropriate, and don't get yourself tied into a position of having to always use the same one. Then in terms of post-instructional, here again, we're talking about a set of activities which by and large are designed sort of to cement in what we've done. It's the telling them you told them. It's the repetition. It's the review part of it as well. A number of ways doing this. Summaries, overviews of one sort or another, outlines. Perhaps the most common of the post-instructional ones is the test. Just the plain old classroom test. Now, let me a couple of things about tests and the use of tests in for post-instructional purposes. I sometimes hear comments that go like this. Every test ought to be a learning experience for students. Every final test ought to be a learning experience for students. One side of me says, yeah, that's true. I would hope every experience a student has in higher education is a learning experience. One side of me says, yeah, that's true. But the other side of me says, the learning had better have occurred before the test has begun. That tests can be used either as pre-instructional, instructional, or post-instructional. But that by and large, when we talk about testing for post-instructional purposes, we are talking about testing which we give and which we design for purposes of evaluating students and our own effectiveness as instructors, not in order to provide more effective instruction in terms of the students who are there. Because by and large, by the time that final test comes, it's too late to do much of anything about it. Now, there's one exception to that, it seems to me. That is if we are dealing in an area and have a course set up or a program set up in some way where, in fact, we are dealing with some kind of mastery learning. Now, do you have courses set up on campus here that have certain specified levels of mastery before students pass out of them? With a student must achieve X percentage on this course before the student is permitted to take the next course in the sequence? Or is your program pretty much on an equal time? Everybody spends pretty much the same amount of time, and you sort of take whatever.